Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Welcome to iHeartRadio Communities, a public affairs special focusing on the biggest issues impacting you this week. Here's Ryan Gorman.
Thanks so much for joining us here on iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman, and we have some important conversations lined up for you. In a moment, I'll talk to a NASA scientist about an exciting new discovery recently made by the Hubble Space Telescope. Then I'll check in with Dr. Dara Kass from the Department of Health and Human Services about the latest information on COVID-19, the vaccines, and who's eligible for this latest round of booster shots. Right now, to get things started, I'm joined by Patty Boyd, chief of the Exoplanets and Stellar Astrophysics Laboratory in the Astrophysics Science Division at NASA, and the project scientist for the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite Mission. Patty, thank you so much for coming on the show. Now, before we get into this groundbreaking observation recently made by the Hubble Space Telescope, tell us a little bit about the work the Hubble has been doing for the past couple of decades.
Oh, I would love to. And thanks for having me. I'm very excited to talk about this groundbreaking discovery from Hubble. So the Hubble Space Telescope is, as its name suggests, in space. It was launched into a low Earth orbit, so it goes around the Earth once every 90 minutes. And it was launched in 1990. And the position of its orbit is such that the space shuttle could rendezvous with it. And over its long life, which is almost 32 years now, there were five servicing missions where astronauts refurbished the instruments and all the systems on board. And in that fifth and final servicing mission, they left the observatory at the peak of its scientific capabilities. So it has continued on making groundbreaking discoveries like the one we're going to talk about today. And we expect it to continue to operate through this decade and hopefully beyond.
So we have the Hubble telescope operating right now. And we also have this new one, the James Webb telescope, which we've heard so much about recently. And the reason I bring that up, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but we're expecting to learn a lot about the origins of the universe from the James Webb telescope. But in this instance, a discovery along those lines was made by Hubble.
You're absolutely right. Hubble and James Webb space telescopes are extremely complementary. So Hubble looks in the optical part of the spectrum, what our eyes can see, but also bluer. We call that the ultraviolet. So you've got ultraviolet and optical with Hubble. And then Webb is designed, it's bigger than Hubble, so it has more collecting area, which means it can see fainter things, but also designed to observe in the infrared part of the spectrum. So the redder things, much redder than Hubble can see with its instruments. And when things are red shifted, those are things that are moving away from us at very far distances in our universe, those get red shifted into the James Webb Space Telescope's region where it can observe. So Hubble and Webb will be extremely complementary. But what's really exciting about today's discovery is that it really pushes Hubble to the limits of what it can observe as far as this being a single star whose light came off that star within the first billion years of the history of our universe. So it's a perfect stepping stone. This object that was discovered by Hubble will actually be observed in detail by Webb very soon.
All right, so the star that the Hubble Space Telescope observed, it took nearly 13 billion years for the light from that star to reach us, and that star was created about 600 million years after the universe was first created. It can be a little difficult to follow and comprehend. Can you put that into some kind of perspective for us?
Sure. And I mean, these are cosmological questions, and they are, you know, they are hard to grasp. Even astronomers have issues grasping them because they're just the unfathomable numbers in time. But we know that our universe started in a Big Bang. We have a lot of observational evidence for that. And at that time, the universe was made of hydrogen, a little bit of helium, not much else, not those heavy elements that we see around us, like carbon, oxygen, neon. Those were all forged in the furnaces of the first stars. So that's why this is such an exciting period of time in the history of our universe. It's about 13.8 billion years old now. And why are we capable of seeing something that old? It's because light actually travels at a finite speed. you don't notice that in your day-to-day interactions, you know, talking to your friends across the table or even talking to your friends on phone. But light does have a finite speed. And what that means is it takes a certain amount of time to reach us. And the things from the very earliest universe, their light has been traveling towards us for almost the entire history of the universe. In this case, the light of the star has been traveling almost 13 billion years to reach our telescope.
Now, that star that the Hubble Space Telescope recently observed, and I'd love for you to tell us the name and what it means and all of that, but in real time, like right now, that star no longer exists, correct?
Absolutely correct. The name of the star is Arendel, which is Old English for morning star. So it's a star from morning in the history of our universe. But our universe has evolved and changed dramatically in the ensuing 12.9 billion years. Not only has that star evolved, it would have had a very quick life because it's a massive star, much more massive than the sun. So they live fast, they die hard, they go out in supernova explosions. So that star is long gone today. But the other change that's happened is that we've changed. The Milky Way galaxy that we live in as the sun itself, that's 100 billion stars or more. And that has evolved as well over those 12.9 billion years. So we look much different than that light, than when that light came from the star, and that star is long gone.
I got to tell you, I find this absolutely fascinating. I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by Patty Boyd, chief of the Exoplanets and Stellar Astrophysics Laboratory in the Astrophysics Science Division at NASA. She's also the project scientist for the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite Mission. So let me see if I have this right. If we were to look back this way from Arendel, the star that was recently observed by the Hubble Space Telescope, would Earth not exist yet?
So our star, the sun, is about 4.9 billion years old right now. So if we were to be able to somehow transport ourselves to Arendel and magically have an observatory there that could then look through this same lensing cluster, so the big, massive galaxy cluster, and look at our Milky Way, we would be seeing that stage of the Milky Way when it was less than a billion years old in the history of the universe. So what we would see would look dramatically different than the Milky Way galaxy that we know today. It would just be forming. It would be in a kind of a chaotic state, not that beautiful spiral structure that we're used to seeing in images and pictures.
So in terms of trying to understand the origins of our universe, the Hubble Space Telescope has observed this star, Arendel, which is the oldest star we've ever observed. But the James Webb Telescope, that's supposed to take us even farther back, right?
Yes, and that's why this is so exciting. It's like such an exciting stepping stone, a taste of what's yet to come with the James Webb Space Telescope. So that telescope is bigger, so it'll be able to see dim objects like this one much more easily than Hubble can. And it's also optimized to see infrared light. So not only is this star, which will give off quite a bit of infrared light, but also the earliest galaxies in our universe, which are red-shifted away from the optical. James Webb was specially designed to go after those first galaxies in the early universe. This is a tantalizing taste of what's to come with James Webb when it starts science operations in this summer.
And ultimately, what does this all mean? Our ability to observe the oldest star we've ever seen to date, or what we're going to see with the James Webb Telescope going even farther back, what are we going to learn from all of this?
It's really about putting together the picture of how did we get here? Where did we come from? How did the universe put together the building blocks of the modern day universe that we see around us today? You know, the stars in our Milky Way, our sun, the planets around our sun. We have a picture of how that has all evolved, including that when solar systems form, the stars form at the center, but that the rocky stuff around it, you know, the dust that's there made up of carbon and other things, not hydrogen and helium, those start to form into planets. And we know that our galaxy is littered with planets right now. There's more planets than stars in the Milky Way galaxy. But all that material that makes up the planets, that was all forged in these first generations of stars, the ones that are very hard to observe. So Arendel will be an excellent example of us to take a look at a star that's evolving in the very earliest part of the universe and to test our models of where those heavier elements come from in the furnaces of these very massive stars. Very young stars.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined right now by Patty Boyd, chief of the Exoplanets and Stellar Astrophysics Laboratory in the Astrophysics Science Division at NASA, and the project scientist for the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite Mission. So the Hubble Space Telescope has been in outer space for decades now, some 30 years. What are some of the biggest things that we've learned from the work that the Hubble has done?
So I think there's a lot of answers to that because, you know, there's a million observations from the Hubble Space Telescope by now. But I think that one of the real legacy programs, one of the legacy results of Hubble was related to these clusters of galaxies or just collections of galaxies. So one of the most iconic images is what we call the Hubble Deep Field, where Hubble was just pointed in a direction of space where it didn't look like there was much going on there. And it just stared there without blinking for days. And what it uncovered was this teeming, a universe teeming with galaxies across cosmic time. And it showed us that galaxies evolve themselves. They collide into each other. They have supermassive black holes at their centers. And those supermassive black holes can often get entangled with each other. So it's really helped us put together that history of the universe. I think that will be one of the enduring legacies of Hubble, is just the deep field and everything that it showed us about how the universe has evolved and come to be.
And what about our little corner in this massive universe, the Milky Way galaxy? What have we learned about the portion of the universe that directly surrounds Earth and our solar system?
So it helps us to put together the story of the structure of the Milky Way. You know, we've got, like I said, over 100 billion stars in the Milky Way. We're just one of 100 billion here. And there is a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. We can see it, how it operates on individual stars over time. And that's very common. When we look at the galaxies that you see in the Hubble Deep Field, we see that the galaxies that are near us in time, in space, they all have supermassive black holes at their core now, too. That's another result that Hubble really helped elucidate, that galaxies and supermassive black holes go hand in hand. So it puts our galaxy in context with other galaxies. But one of the most enduring questions that James Webb was designed to answer is, which came first? Did the massive supermassive black holes form first and then galaxies formed around them? Or did the galaxies form first and then somehow those supermassive black holes sunk into the middle with all that mass? We're talking like millions of masses of the sun or more. So it definitely helps us put the Milky Way in context as far as its evolution goes, as far as its content goes. But we're really waiting for the James Webb Space Telescope to kind of open that chapter of the book, chapter one in how galaxies form and evolve.
And real quick, on the topic of black holes, are they still one of the biggest mysteries in the universe? Do we know what happens in them or how they work?
Especially the dynamics around supermassive black holes is pretty well understood and very well modeled by theories like general relativity. You know, what happens around a supermassive black hole is you're really looking at how matter and space-time itself behave in extremes, in the extremely, the limit of extreme mass. So we have a lot of examples of how we can observe activity around supermassive black holes. The real question is, how did they get there? When did they get there? And did they influence the development of the galaxies and the galactic structure, or was it the other way around?
I'm Ryan Gorman with Patty Boyd, chief of the Exoplanets and Stellar Astrophysics Laboratory in the Astrophysics Science Division at NASA. She's also the project scientist for the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite Mission. Obviously, one of the big areas of interest for just about everyone, is there other intelligent life out there in the universe? The work that the Hubble Space Telescope has done, the work that the James Webb Telescope is going to do, are those two missions helping us answer that question?
Oh, absolutely. But now we're really talking about, you know, when we're talking about Arendelle, we're talking about a star that is at cosmic distances. When we're talking about exoplanets, we're actually talking about very small objects. And so those are easiest to see around the nearest stars. So what the community, the astronomical community, is really focused on now is finding examples of exoplanets. So these are planets around other stars. We want to find the ones that are around nearby and bright stars. Why is that? Because the signal from them is relatively strong because they are close. And what Hubble and Webb can start to do now is if a planet passes in front of its star, if it's got an atmosphere, when it blocks some of that light from the star, some of that light would pass through the atmosphere and it would get imprinted with the material that's in the atmosphere. So that allows us to take a look at the planet as a place and tell me something about that atmosphere. What's it made of? Does it have oxygen and carbon dioxide and ozone in its atmosphere like ours does? Hubble is not quite capable of doing that type of a sophisticated spectral analysis on a planet like the Earth.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It can do this type of an analysis on giant planets like Jupiter and Saturn. What Webb is going to help us do is push down to smaller planets and to really look for some of those constituents in the atmosphere that we think are consistent with developing life on a planet. So the ones that I named are markers that we're going to be looking for: methane, ozone, oxygen, and water vapor, because here on Earth, water and life go hand in hand. It's a rule, right? If you see water, you see life. If you have life, it has to have access to water. And we know that the laws of physics and chemistry are universal. We see them everywhere in the universe. So if science is universal, there's very good reason to think that the laws of biology will also be universal. And this is the reason that we follow the water vapor. Really looking forward to being able to disentangle some of that stuff with Webb and exoplanets.
Well, I tell you what, it is such an exciting time when it comes to space exploration. Sometimes it's a little hard to wrap your head around some of these concepts, but the information that we keep getting, including this most recent development from the Hubble Space Telescope, just fascinating. Patty Boyd, Chief of the Exoplanets and Stellar Astrophysics Laboratory in the Astrophysics Science Division at NASA and the Project Scientist for the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite Mission. Patty, can't thank you enough for coming on the show and breaking all of that down for us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. And finally, let's turn to Dr. Dara Kass, HHS Regional Director for Region 2. She's with us to talk about COVID-19, the vaccines, and the latest information on boosters. Dr. Kass, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk to us. And let's start with an overview of the work you do at HHS overseeing Region 2.
So I first want to say thank you so much for having me, Ryan. Getting to the communities is really what matters. It's why we do this work. I am an emergency medicine doctor. Like I said, I've been working in the ER for almost 20 years. In November, I joined the Biden administration as the regional director for Region 2, which serves New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, which allows us to really connect the work of the federal government with the people that we're here to serve, right? The people on the ground, to make sure that what we're doing is communicated to them and that we're hearing what they need.
And before we get into all the latest information on the vaccines and on COVID-19, the different variants and all of that, tell us a little bit about your personal experience with this virus, because both personally and professionally, you have been consumed by COVID for the past couple of years.
Yeah. And certainly, if you ask my children, it certainly takes up all of my time.
Right.
I was an emergency medicine doctor in New York City in March of 2020. And so I was on the front lines as this virus really, you know, kind of decimated our country in the first pass. I worked in the ER in March and found myself actually infected with COVID-19 in that second week of March of 2020. And, you know, the thing about that infection early on, and it really will kind of speak to our conversation a little bit today about where we are now in this pandemic, is the uncertainty of that time, watching so many people get sick, getting sick myself, watching my friends have unexpected courses of illness. These are people that never expected to be in the hospital, never worried about their own mortality, right? Women like me that had young children, thinking about whether or not they needed to write their will. And so when I got sick, I got scared. Right? The uncertainty was crippling,
sure.
Not knowing, would I be able to breathe? Am I going to bring it home to my family? And I think that anxiety around the uncertainty has really informed so many of the reactions to the policies we've been putting in place and really how people feel about how it impacts their lives, because we're looking for certainty in a time that is so confusing. So I recovered from my infection in March of 2020, and I went back to work in the ER. I was able to care for people and really start communicating that this is our lives. This is affecting our day-to-day. How are we managing our children, our parents, right? How are we considering the risks to our families? And then I was able to get vaccinated in December of 2020 as it was first being offered to people and got vaccinated and boosted. And we'll talk about my second COVID infection later on when we talk about the impact of the vaccine on infections and really the consideration of what it means to be vaccinated but still get COVID afterwards.
That time frame in March of 2020, because we tend to have short memories, can you bring us back to what you were experiencing, what you were seeing on the front lines, really ground zero for this virus when it first started to impact this country?
So I can say that it was scary. I mean, there's no other word to describe it, right? We were working as hard as we could with the information we had, and we really tried to keep ourselves safe and our patients safe at a time where we're seeing something we had never seen before, this respiratory virus that was just spreading amongst our communities and really kind of taking the floor out from under us. And I can say that, you know, especially in New York where I live, our community came together. We really kind of addressed this as a community-based approach. We put on our masks. We, you know, most people stayed home, only people that had to go to work. And what that meant, I think, was changing over the course of the pandemic. But, you know, we really tried to stick together as a community. And New York really saw an incredible response from that. And then as those waves, you know, went through this country, we saw communities come together and show their best selves to stick up for each other and stand together in addressing these waves as they come through. And I still think that we see this now, although the fatigue, the exhaustion of making those decisions over and over again, over two, now almost 3 years, is really wearing on people. And I think we're seeing that now in just the desire for people to just have answers and move on. And that's hard to do even at this point in the pandemic.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by Dr. Dara Kass, HHS Regional Director for Region 2. And let's dive into some of the latest information on the vaccines and COVID-19. And I think a lot of people are asking themselves, if these vaccines don't keep me from getting COVID-19, which we have learned with these most recent variants, in a lot of instances they don't, what's the point in getting vaccinated and boosted? What can you tell us about that?
So first of all, vaccination matters, right? I think that that is an important point that we need to just put as the foundation of this conversation. And getting boosted matters as well. And again, I'll use an example from my own life. My 14-year-old daughter, who is fully vaccinated and boosted, found herself having a positive rapid COVID test last week. You know, she started having a sore throat and her nose was runny. And, you know, we have rapid tests in our house. Thanks to the resources of the federal government, everyone we know can go to COVID.gov and order their tests and find out where their local testing centers are. And we had them in our house. So she tested herself. Actually, her first test was negative, but 2 days later, she was positive. And so she was able to, you know, stay home and isolate from our family and actually didn't give it to anybody else in our family. But the interesting thing for me as a mom was, you know, when my first COVID infection happened in March of 2020, I was worried about my actual health and wellness. Would I have to go to the hospital? Would I even survive this? With my daughter, who had 3 vaccines before she was infected, I was not worried about that. Her biggest concern was, what do I do to make up my math test?
Yeah,
right? And even in our home, right? I mean, and she's 14 years old, so that was a really big deal. But the bottom line is, in our house, we have an immune compromised person. My 9-year-old son had a liver transplant. And he also was fully vaccinated. For him, that means 3 vaccines, even though he's 9. And even in that case of having somebody in our home who was COVID positive and having an immune compromised family member, I was not nervous more than I will deal with whatever comes in front of us, that we had not done every single thing we could to protect our family. And that's the power of the vaccines and the boosters. You know that even if you do get infected, you've done everything you can do to protect your family and keep them as safe as humanly possible.
And what about those who have been infected? Maybe they've been infected multiple times. Maybe they were infected back in March of 2020, and then they've been infected with Delta or Omicron, and they're saying to themselves, why do I need to go get vaccinated? I have natural immunity. I've caught COVID before. What do you say to them?
So this is what I say. I say that, you know, there is no better immunity and no more reliable immunity than vaccinated immunity. It does not undermine the experience that people have had COVID have had. But it's really important to remember that even if you've had COVID and you've survived and you've had, you know, you have your antibodies and you have and you are ready to move on, there is no better protection than getting that at least primary series and really that booster on top of it. And, you know, I know that it can be frustrating if even after that you get COVID, but we know that the vaccinations provide more durable immunity and better protection than just the immunity you get from an infection alone. And we've seen people get two, and some I've heard of three people get people getting it three times, you know, the infections, because as each strain comes out, you are more vulnerable to that strain without the vaccine. So I think it's really important to acknowledge the experience of people that have had COVID and have had natural immunity and natural infections from post-infections. But it is important to recognize that the vaccine is absolutely our most durable and reliable protection for this virus.
Before we get into the information on the boosters and why they're so important, can you tell us first who's eligible to receive them?
Sure. So the way we talk about boosters, right? So there's a primary series, which is the original two shots of the mRNA vaccine or one Johnson & Johnson. And then there is the booster. And that's really everybody over the age of 12 is eligible for that booster. It's really important to have that at the time frame that matches whichever your vaccine was. So if you had a Moderna or a Pfizer vaccine, you can have it 5 months after that primary series and 2 months after you had J&J. So that's the booster that we talk about, where everyone over the age of 12, which is my 14-year-old daughter and my 49-year-old husband, who's not going to be thrilled that I told you how old he was, you know, we are all eligible. But then you get to my 76-year-old mother, and now I'm going to be in big trouble, okay? So she is eligible for a second booster. In fact, just got hers yesterday, and that is new information. Everybody over the age of 50 is eligible for a second booster, you know, because of the protection and the priming of the immune system that provides. And that's, again, after a timeline from either your mRNA or your Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It's really, really important that everyone over the age of 65, you know, 75, gets that booster as soon as possible. And everyone over the age of 50 who is eligible should really speak to their doctor about whether or not they should get that booster and how fast they should get it. There are a lot of conversations out there for people that are eligible, finding out if it's their time to do that. And I think that that's why the recommendation was, please speak to your doctor because you are eligible. But if you are, you know, over 65, have an immune compromised condition, at all vulnerable at all for your particular infection, we really think this additional booster will help you be as protected as possible if you get COVID-19.
I'm Ryan Gorman, joined by Dr. Dara Kass, HHS Regional Director for Region 2. We're talking about the COVID-19 vaccines and boosters. And I think inevitably you're going to have people say, especially talking about this fourth booster shot, that, you know, I just don't want to go through that period after you get the booster shot where, you know, you feel a little under the weather for maybe a day or two. Do I really need to get yet another one? But you are adamant about the fact that this latest booster for those over the age of 50, it is important to keep that immunity at a certain level so people don't get severely ill with COVID-19.
Yeah, I mean, remember that those feelings you have after that vaccine, after that booster, that's your immune system working. So in all fairness, if you don't feel that way, maybe you'll be a little sad. I get all excited when I have a little bit of a sore arm or I have a little bit of redness.
Most people don't.
That's my... I know. It's all about perspective though, right? And I will also remind you, and I think this is an important thing to reflect on, is that getting COVID itself is no walk in the park, even if you're not in danger.
Right.
And so I want to be really clear that, you know, a lot of this perception around the milder variants, right? So what we've seen with Omicron and now this BA2, people talk about how it's less severe, it's more mild. And I do want to be very clear that having had it, it isn't fun.
Yeah.
And you don't want to get a severe case or even a, you know, if you're going to be symptomatic, you want to have as best protection as possible. And back to my daughter, right? She had 3 days of a positive test. I mean, she's still masked up when she went back to school after 5, but she was only rapid test positive for 3 days. And I really believe that is because her body was ready for that infection when mm-hmm. she was infected. You know, and even for me, my course with this Omicron version, I got it again in December of 2021. You know, my husband likes to say I'm very good at getting COVID. You know, I got it again. And it's really, it was not the same experience I had the first time. It, like, again, it wasn't a walk in the park and I'm not trying to get COVID, but it was definitely less, it was shorter and it was less severe. And I give some respect to the vaccines for getting me there.
And real quick, COVID.gov, that's the one-stop shop where people can find out information on test kits and all of that. And vaccines.gov, that's where everyone can go for all the information on the COVID-19 vaccines.
Yeah, so it's basically a one-stop shop. So you go to COVID.gov and you can find information on your local community spread, which is really, really important, right? When we ask people to consider wearing a mask, we're asking them to look at their community and their personal risk and understand what is the transmission rate? What are the hospitalizations in your community? So people may choose to put a mask on in 2 weeks, even if they're not wearing one right now.
All right. And again, all the information on the vaccines you can find at vaccines.gov. Dr. Dara Kass, HHS Regional Director for Region 2. Dr. Kass, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ryan. Have a great day, okay?
All right. And that's going to do it for this edition of iHeartRadio Communities. I'm Ryan Gorman. We'll be back same time, same place next weekend. Thanks so much for listening.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky?
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.